The site is called Tel Karkur. That's the name of it. Tel is the word in Arabic for a large mounded ancient settlement. They're usually ancient towns or cities that formed progressively over time by the collapsing of mud brick buildings. So they made buildings out of mud brick, or what we sometimes call adobe here in the United States. And it's located in the Orontes River Valley, which is in western Syria, that is on the kind of eastern edge of the Mediterranean Sea. So between Turkey and Lebanon, Syria has a stretch of coastline. So this big tell was occupied for something like 10,000 years or so. So it's a very, very long-lived tell. Its earliest occupation goes back to the very earliest permanent settlements. So prior to that, people were hunter-gatherers, and then they settled down and started farming. So these were the first agricultural communities in the world. It's about 30 meters or 100 feet tall off the floodplain. So when you're standing on the plain, it's this big, tall mound. Mm-hmm. And it covers about, 15 hectares. I don't know what that is in acres. You don't miss it when you're driving past. It looks like a giant hill today, sort of.
Now, when you go in and start conducting research at such a site, do you already have questions in mind, or do you kind of come across things and you're like, okay?
Oh, no, yeah, absolutely. There's archaeological research today is problem-driven. That is, like any scientific method, you would have a question, a hypothesis about mm-hmm. something, and then find a suitable place to explore that question. In this particular case, the site had been excavated for a while before I got there. The first long-term excavation was done by this guy, Rudy Dorneman, who is the executive director of the American Schools of Oriental Research, okay. ASOR, as it's sometimes called by people in the field. ASOR originally decided that they were interested in finding a place to excavate in Syria, particularly in unexplored regions. And they were particularly interested in a period that we call the Iron Age. That's the first millennium BC, the period from about, 1200 BC through about 500 BC or so, largely because of its biblical connections. Tel Karkur is almost certainly the same as a historical city known as Karkar that is written about in the royal inscriptions of the Neo-Assyrian king named Shalmaneser III, who some listeners might remember from the Old Testament. And my interests were more in looking at long-term changes in settlement in this region. I find it a fascinating area in terms of the longevity of occupation that's it's seen. And a lot of my work is dedicated to exploring the way that settlement changed over time in terms of the density mm-hmm. and number of sites, which is a proxy for, say, the population of a region. We look at how that population was concentrated in, say, urban versus rural areas and where it was located, whether in the floodplain or up in the mountains or on the desert fringe. And by consequence, then the sorts of land use strategies that those people employed. Over time, agricultural practices or the way that they would, use resources changed a great deal.
You found evidence of continuity of a civilization in a period of severe drought when all the other ancient civilizations were dying.
Yes, that's right. Over the period that people have been living in the Middle East, there have been numerous times when there were widespread abandonments of archaeological sites contemporary with the sort of dissolution of political powers that had ruled the region. We saw that a lot of different times. But one of the most well-known of those and often studied by archaeologists was this period in the late 3rd millennium BC. That's, right around, say, between 2200 and 2000 BC or so. Mm-hmm. Leading up to that, in the few centuries that were prior, that was really the time when this region and much of the world had seen the first explosion of what we would think of as urban civilization. These were big cities with writing and monumental architecture and mm-hmm. kings and armies and so forth. And those civilizations appeared more or less simultaneously in lots of regions, in Mesopotamia, mm-hmm. in Egypt, that was the Old Kingdom in Egypt, in the Indus Valley, where it was the Harappan civilization and many other regions. And then, seemingly at around the same time, a lot of those civilizations suffered what would be commonly called a collapse, right? Mm-hmm. So that means a sort of fragmentation of their political power. So there were no more kings. And that brought with it the abandonment of lots of the largest cities, the termination of major construction projects, so there's no more big monumental buildings, and the abandonment of lots and lots of other sites in certain regions. In Egypt, that was the end of Old Kingdom Egypt when the pyramids were built. That was the end of the Harappan civilization. And in Mesopotamia, that was the end of the empire that we call the Akkadians. So this is something that has interested archaeologists for a long time, understanding why that took place and what the causes of it were and what its consequences were. And one of the well-known theories about this, especially among the public, is one originally put forward in 1993 by this guy from Yale named mm-hmm. Harvey Weitz, who proposed that a hyper-arid climatic episode had driven the collapse of these civilizations, that it had led to a very severe drought, and that everybody just collapsed, essentially. And that's been a contentious theory. Not everyone believes it. And so that's where my site comes in as significant, because it wasn't abandoned. People continued living there. They were prospering, thriving throughout this period. And so we get kind of a unique window into what was going on at a time when lots of other sites were abandoned.
Have you looked into explanations of why this particular civilization survived, or is that still a question that you're working on?
You know, it's still certainly a question. So Tel Karkur, where I'm excavating, is not totally unique in this sense. We know very little, really, about what's going on. But based on surface evidence, that is, collecting those potsherds from the surface of sites, mm-hmm. I believe that there are many other sites in this region that continued to be occupied as well. And so why that is, was there a sort of more stable political environment there that, you know, encouraged them to continue living? Was it something environmental? There's not a single cause. These things are driven by the intersection of all kinds of social mm-hmm. and environmental forces. And as archaeologists, it's often difficult to know what all of those are, because we deal with very fragmentary evidence.
Now, I was talking to Kyle about your research.
Yeah.
And he told me that, I think you told him that you discovered the oldest window.
I wouldn't say I discovered the oldest window necessarily. I was a team member on another project. The project was a place called Ein Ghazal, which is just outside of Amman, Jordan. And dating back to about, say, 7500 BC, something like that. I was told at the time this was the oldest window, and it very well may still be.
But that's pretty cool. You do know that, right?
I'm more proud about some of the other things that I've found over the years.
Yes, please talk about those.
Well, so a lot of my work has to do with sort of regionally focused projects. Mm-hmm. Excavation is only a small part of where I would see my own expertise. One of my major areas of research is what we call archaeological survey, which involves going around this larger landscape and trying to document these things that mm-hmm. are. And, you know, in a region like that, one finds remarkable things. I've documented previously lost Crusader forts and standing Roman ruins. I found a Greek temple on top of a mountain one time. I mean, we find amazing things out there, and it's just astonishing what you can find simply by walking around this place. In the meantime, a major initiative that we have going on here at the mm-hmm. university involves the use of declassified Cold War era satellite imagery. So this is the first generation ever of spy satellites that were flown between 1960 and 1972. They were just taken on large black and white rolls of film, but then were classified and left rotting in the basement of the Pentagon or something until the mid-90s when Bill Clinton declassified them with an executive order.
Okay.
Since the late 90s, archaeologists have picked these up and started working on them, and they're just phenomenal images because the landscape of the Middle East and many places in the world has changed dramatically in recent decades as cities have grown and agriculture has become mechanized so that they bulldoze things and deep plow things and irrigate things that they never did before. They build these huge reservoirs, and that floods countless archaeological sites. Many of the same kinds of changes we see here, except that in the Middle East, in the 1960s, agriculture was done with a donkey plow, and cities were quite small. And that meant that the archaeological sites and other features like ancient roadways or ancient fields or canals are also very well preserved and visible on this imagery. So this old imagery preserves a picture of the landscape that no longer exists. So at CAST, the Center for Advanced Spatial Technologies, me and my colleague Jack Cawthron, who's the director there, have been working for the past few years to assemble this amazing resource of imagery known as Corona, and are now giving it away for free. So we've come up with new methods to correct the spatial distortions in the imagery so that you can easily see it. Now are using it with funding from NASA to map archaeological sites across the entire Northern Fertile Crescent, a region extending from Lebanon through Syria, southern Turkey, and northern Iraq. So, yeah, I mean, these are the kinds of things I really like doing and what we'll continue to do regardless of the political situation in the Middle East.
What questions now do you look forward to answering?
In Syria, I'm particularly excited at Tel Karkur. We go for 6 weeks or something in the summer, and so the last time we went was in 2010. And there's kind of a cliche that the best discoveries are always made like on the last afternoon of the last day of fieldwork, because
of course.
And so in this case, that's what happened. And so the very last day, one of my graduate students here, Tuna Kalija, was walking around in the fields looking for to see how far pottery or artifacts extend out from the site. And he said he found some pottery over several hundred meters to the east of the mountain. And so I said, well, I'm going to go check it out. So I went to look at it. And it's quite remarkable because it was a huge area covering, many acres that was covered entirely with pottery of a single period. The period being the 4th millennium BC. So the period between about, say, 4,000 and 3,000 BC. It's a long time ago. And especially at a site like mine, we never find things that are only of one period. Everything's all mixed together and messy. And that means that it's often poorly preserved. And, to dig to anything interesting, you have to dig down 5 meters through. And in this case, it was this very, very early phase. All at the surface. It's a peach. It's ready to excavate or investigate in other ways. And it's a very interesting period, historically and culturally speaking, because this is the time when the world's first cities emerged.
Being an archaeologist, you have this very different perspective of the past. Does it change your perspective of the present or the future?
Yes, it definitely changes one's perspective. I think archaeology, especially given the longevity of time that we deal with so casually and tossing around centuries like they're nothing. It sort of makes one feel a little small, I suppose, in the same sense that I imagine astronomers must feel.